I knew that the space was very diverse, but unfortunately the output from like, you know, video game essayists and commentators were like incredibly right wing.
Yeah.
And I think that they were radicalizing a lot of people. And YouTube probably played a big role in that too, like the YouTube algorithm. But I saw that and I was like, this is not right. This is not correct. I think there are a lot of people that also would understand my perspective and would probably mesh better with my worldview than these like neck bearded divorced dads that are talking about, you know, the great replacement and you know, having Richard Spencer on.
Yeah.
Those guys are fucking weirdo losers, you know what I mean? And they're not real gamers either.
I'm Jon Favreau. Welcome to Offline. Hey, everyone. My guest today is Hassan Piker, Twitch's favorite political commentator. If you know Hassan and watch his streams, you'll love this interview. We talk about everything you'd expect. Fox firing Tucker, Biden 2024, liberals versus leftists, Hassan's new puppy. But if you're not familiar with Hassan, here's what you need to know. He's one of Gen Z's most influential political commentators. He's probably most famous for a 2020 Among Us stream where he played the popular video game with Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and a series of other prominent Twitch personalities. At the time, the stream was one of the most popular in Twitch's history. Since then, Hassan's reach has grown rapidly. Today, he has a dedicated following of 2.5 million, which he streams to for 8 hours a day, 7 days a week, often attracting more than 500,000 viewers. To put that in context, Wolf Blitzer averages around 600,000 viewers a day. Hassan is known for his casual approach to political commentary, which is to say that he says whatever he thinks and does not give much of a shit what people think. His streams often consist of him sitting in front of the computer, browsing Twitter or news sites, and offering up commentary in context in real time, live on stream. Hassan's a proud leftist, but also someone who believes it's possible and necessary to persuade people with different views. I wanted to talk to Hassan about how he does this and how he thinks about talking politics to young people, specifically to the type of young man Laura Bates and I spoke about last week. We also had a bigger conversation about the current state of political media, why he thinks some on the left do too much scolding, what he thinks of the Biden administration, and the demands of talking politics live 7 days a week. Obviously, the two of us have some different views, which we could have debated for hours, but I thought it was especially useful to hear Hassan's perspective as someone with a young, politically engaged audience who's thought a lot about persuasion and media in our extremely online era. As always, if you have comments, questions, or episode ideas, please email us at offline@cricket.com. And I should warn you now, Max Fisher will be joining us next week, and he's busy working on some big surprises we have in store for the show in the next month. Here's Hassan Piker. Hassan Piker, welcome to Offline.
Thank you for having me. This is incredibly professional. I didn't even realize, like, I did not realize how crazy this was. Didn't you guys used to, like, shoot out of the cast studio or whatever?
There was that.
Yeah.
We also had an office, like, around La Cienega that was, like, across from a strip club and that had one bathroom in the kitchen. So that was our first.
Yeah.
So this is better than that.
I mean, I have two podcasts, and I shoot out of my living room.
We did that. Well,
I shoot out of my studio, I guess. Living room converted to a studio.
We like refurbished this studio right before the pandemic, and then we all recorded out of our homes for about a year and a half.
Yeah.
I want to start out with the biggest media news of the week, maybe the year. You adopted a puppy.
Yeah.
How's your first week as a dog dad?
It was terrible. I completely forgot what it was like. It's been a very long time since I had a puppy. I'm sick. I've been sleeping, you know, around 2 hours. That's as much as she lets me sleep, basically.
How many weeks, months is she?
She's 7 weeks old.
Oh, like, 7 weeks. Like, yeah, so you're like at the beginning.
Yeah.
Oh, that's brutal.
So she sleeps all day. And then, I mean, that's what puppies do. Until she wakes up and she's like, I need playtime right now. And then she sleeps at night for, you know, she's up at night pooping and peeing everywhere.
When we got a puppy when we moved here in 2014, and at the time I was working out of our house in West Hollywood, and my wife was at working at a PR place. She came home. I was taking care
of
the puppy.
She used to do PR for us.
You know Emily. I was going to say.
So back when I used to work at the Young Turks.
So Emily comes home from Sunshine, and I'm sitting there just covered in shit because Leo was in the crate, and they're like, oh, they don't shit in the crate. That's the whole thing. But he did shit in the crate as a puppy. Yeah. And I was just like on the phone with my mom. I'm like, what am I supposed to do? There's shit everywhere.
It was and you're like freaking out. You're like, is there something wrong with this dog? It's like, no, they do that. They lie to you when they say, you know, even if you get like a small crate.
Yeah.
That's the idea. The idea is that like they won't shit where they sleep. That's a lie.
It's a lie.
Puppies don't care.
Everyone told us when we had a puppy, like, well, it's good training for a kid. I'll just say, having a kid, it's so much harder, like infinitely harder to have a child. Yeah. Now we have our dog and I'm like, oh, Leo, you were so easy.
Yeah.
So just, yeah.
Yeah. Animals are like autopilot.
Once they get trained, you're like good to go.
Kids can't do anything. You put a sandwich in front of a kid, he doesn't know what's going on.
Nope. And every new stage is something else you got to worry about. All right, let's get to media and politics here. You talked about Fox firing Tucker Carlson earlier this week. Who knows if we'll ever find out the real reason they shit canned their most profitable white nationalist. But I'm curious, like, how much of that show's success do you think was driven by Tucker, and how much was because of the platform that a primetime Fox show provides whatever host is filming?
That's a really good question, because the other formerly shit canned host also was kind of popping as well, Bill O'Reilly.
Right.
And it could have something to do with that slot. I think Rupert Murdoch was basically making that bet. He was like, no, this is the slot. It's not the person that you put in the slot. I think marginally it will improve no matter what happens, because Tucker Carlson is a very dangerous white nationalist propagandist who is like ideologically invested in a white nationalist project. Unlike, you know, Sean Hannity's just like regular Republican, you know,
I mean, he's just still like a hack. He's like a Trump lackey, you know.
Yeah, he's a regular Republican bootlicker. He will, you know, a brown nosed Donald Trump or whoever's in power. You know, he's a guy. He's a machine guy. Tucker is a bit like that too, but he also I think has like consistent white nationalist ideological principles, which I find very scary. Like additionally scary in comparison to your average run-of-the-mill Republican racist guy. But you do bring up a really interesting point. I think it's partially because it's primetime Fox News, but I also do think that, you know, they're probably not going to find a guy like Tucker again.
I tend to agree. I also don't know that Tucker will be able to find that level of success somewhere else, because I just don't know that there are platforms as big or influential as Fox right now.
You are so right. Yeah. I looked into this, as a matter of fact, with Bill O'Reilly.
Yeah.
After, you know, the 700,000th lawsuit about Bill O'Reilly trying to sexually harass an intern or telling them, you know, to use a loofah, like the phone or whatever, after he got fired, Bill O'Reilly's website gets like, I think, 1 million hits a month.
Yeah.
Whereas the Fox News website gets, and Fox News website is definitely not their main revenue driver at all, but it gets like 327 million a month, I think.
Yeah.
So like, you know, Bill O'Reilly's podcast is number 72 on the Apple charts for news. He got a doctor who used to perform abortions murdered. You know what I mean? Yeah, George Tiller was murdered because of Bill O'Reilly. He used to call him Tiller, the baby killer. And then someone went to the church that he was at and shot this guy. That's how popular and prolific and important Bill O'Reilly was. And now he's got a fucking podcast that, like, I mean, you wouldn't have him on as a guest. You'd be like, I don't even fucking...
I didn't even know he had a podcast.
Yeah,
I know he's like still writing like Killing Linking books, or like he's every once in a while he turns out a book that like goes to the top of the charts there. But other than that, like Glenn Beck, Bill O'Reilly, Megyn Kelly, none of them have found the same success.
Yeah, Glenn Beck, another absolute failure of a media platform that's like constantly in a state of disarray. So they're just like always looking for the new vampire billionaire donor to come in and just be like, save us, please. you know, there's an industry for it. They got like great make work programs for these fail sons.
Well, you are someone who, like me and my co-hosts, started your show in part because you were worried about the reach and influence of right-wing propaganda, especially among young people. When you started doing political analysis for Young Turks, did you have a theory of the case as to how you'd reach people and persuade them not to buy into the rights bullshit?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I always thought was that the Democratic Party is just god-awful. And now I think it's by design, but that's a whole different subject. But I thought that they were just like really bad at messaging to anyone, really. Anyone other than like a very specific zip code where like of like New York Times subscribers that are like more invested in this notion of like, you know, Americans following their profoundly important civic duties and people who just care about civility over anything else. You know what I mean? Like the Dianne Feinstein shouldn't be forced to retire actually because she's a girl boss crowd. Like,
yeah, could be a little clubby.
Yeah, it's just like outside of that, most people are just like, dude, please, like, I'm looking at the state of the Republican Party at the state legislature level, and they're literally, they just signed like another murder trans teenager bill, and they're passing it through the state legislature. People are protesting. It doesn't matter. They're like, you know, beating the shit out of the protesters with the cops. Meanwhile, you know, you're over here talking about civility. Like, what the fuck's going on? Like, most people in the Democratic Party are assuming a defensive posture in voting. Anyway, I went into this like grand theory, but my point is, in spite of all of that, they are still very bad at messaging. And I thought, you know, one of the main ways to communicate to people my personal desires and my personal politics is just by being a normal guy, you know, instead of being this like kind of pedantic, academia-focused, uptight person who's like doing way too much cultural analysis in a similar vein to like what Republicans do, but at least Republicans are doing it in a funny way, unintentionally.
Yeah. Well, that, I mean, yeah. Has your theory of the case sort of changed at all over the years since you've been doing this as the media landscape and the political environment has changed quite a bit over the last several years?
I mean, not really.
Yeah.
I think in many ways, the basics are still there for me. I've only become more pessimistic. And
about politics, democracy?
Yeah, all of those things, for sure. And I think the fundamentals that I originally started off with, whether it be like media being an arm of capital, in reinforcing and communicating and normalizing the oppression that people feel under unjustifiable hierarchies, or, you know, anything that Noam Chomsky's written about, the media manufacturing consent, that was my starting point. That was the fundamentals. That was the bare bones of what I believed in. But I was like, maybe there's some people out there that are, you know, doughy-eyed and they have a different perspective and it's not like that. And no, I went back to square one, and I am more of a firm believer in that now than I was before. So I think that's what happened.
Last week, I talked to Laura Bates, who spent a lot of time researching and writing about how the internet is radicalizing young men. They start with, you know, these lightly misogynistic videos and memes, and then they end up Jordan Peterson fans or incels or even worse. How do you think about what's required to prevent that kind of radicalization? And like, do you think about that while you do your show?
Yeah, no, for sure. I do that all the time. I mean, it's something that I'm trying to explain to people quite frequently. A lot of people on the left, on the hyper online side of things, will look to someone like myself and go, that guy's too bro-y. Like, he seems like he's going to say something that's like a microaggression or whatever. And I'm like, no, that's like the point. That's me. Like, it's how I am. If you are here and if you've been following me for the past 10 years, you know what I believe, you know what my perspective is, you know what I've been advocating for. It's all online. Like, it's not something that I hide. I've been getting death threats over it for the fucking past decade. So you can look to that and see if I am those things.
Yeah.
Or you could just continue hyper-focusing on the aesthetics. The aesthetics are important, though, because I think that, you know, we are primal lizard brain idiots for the most part, and we look to someone that we can identify with. And I think that for a lot of people online, they just look to someone like myself and they're like, oh, this guy is, you know, he's not super uptight. super academic. He calls himself a dumbass, which I am. And I think that that is something that they vibe with, they mesh with. Whereas, obviously, I don't think I can deconstruct the systems themselves. And there is a reason why a guy like Andrew Tate can, like, basically have this torpedo effect where he just blows up. He takes off like a rocket ship out of nowhere because he's, like, writing for misogyny.
Yeah.
And there's always going to be much larger fans or people who are socially conditioned and have these biases baked in and want to have those biases reinforced. So there's a lot more fans of misogyny. So therefore, there are a lot of people who can take advantage of that rather than vice versa, like deconstruct those components and try to re-educate people. But yeah, ultimately, I do my very best to just be a normal person and explain to people where they're at.
Are you constantly weighing it all in your head as you're speaking? Like, okay, I want to be real. I want to be myself. But I also don't want to say something too offensive, or that people might think that's offensive, what I just said, but I don't really give a shit. I feel like you are not worried about being canceled.
No, because it's bullshit. It's not a real thing. It's like something that podcasters talk about all the fucking time. But like the reality is, it's not a real thing. It's just like, you know what cancel culture is? You know who cancel culture is real for? The dude that works at fucking Jiffy Lube, okay?
Yeah.
You can get, if you're like a regular guy listening to this podcast, you can get quote-unquote canceled. Why? Because, you know, you have no labor protections. So your boss could just be like, I don't like you. You're fucking fired. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's cancellation. That's like what a cancellation would be ostensibly. Podcasters don't have those problems. So I think that in a way, it's a very fun way for podcasters to make it seem like, I'm just like you. What's happening to me can happen to you. You know how like Trump is like, if I am convicted of a crime, you can be too. And it's like, yeah, that's a very weirdly specific, you know, I don't think the Manhattan DA is going to fucking charge anyone else for paying hush money to a porn star, possibly through campaign donations, and your lawyer went to fucking jail for it already. Like, that's like an insanely specific thing. To the average Joe, you know, the average Joe would have been in jail, you know, 10 steps before you.
Yeah.
Right? It's the same concept, it's the same principle. Having said that, it's really fucking annoying. It is profoundly annoying, cancel culture. People misconstrue what you're saying all the time. I speak for 8 to 10 hours every day. You know, my mind rushes in a million different directions. I have ADHD, as you can probably tell. It's very difficult for me to you know, coherently describe exactly what I believe. Sometimes people misconstrue it. Sometimes people weaponize it. It's like a very normal part of this media landscape that we live in. Ultimately, you can only be quote-unquote canceled by, in the podcast world at least, or in the media world, by your own fan base.
You've said that the left can be very successfully turned into a cartoonish depiction of a hysterical person, someone who doesn't see any joy in life. I want to show people that you can be a progressive and not be a total fucking scold. I think about this constantly, especially over the last couple of years. What is it about the left, do you think, that lends itself to that caricature?
I think people are well-intentioned overall. I want to believe that they're well-intentioned overall. And if you're like a very empathetic person and you don't understand the context or nuance behind like, you know, a piece of comedy or something, and you feel like the only place that you have any kind of power, in an otherwise cruel world where you feel completely powerless, because you can't do anything about like actual racism, like systemic failures, you can't do anything about reforming the criminal justice system, you hyper-focus on, you know, cultural analysis, and you hyper-focus on like what TV show you can kind of yell about, or you hyper-focus on like language and changing language and I think that one of the major components of the left behaving this way sometimes, especially online, is that it's the only thing they know and it's the only thing that they've gotten like positive reinforcement out of. And by positive reinforcement, I mean like a corporation actually reacting and saying, sorry, we fucked up. We're going to change it. Because, you know, no matter how much you yell at the Democratic Party, like they are still going to give extra armored personnel carriers of the police force. You know what I mean? Like, they're not fixing the fucking potholes. Sorry. The cops need extra Kevlar vests and you know, APCs. But at least, like, I can get a TV show to change someone that worked there, like, change the cast of a TV show, and then all of a sudden I feel like I've done something. So that's one component. The other thing that I have experienced a lot on Twitch, where I'm live every day and I, like, talk to people nonstop, constantly. I have an arena full of people listening, but they can also say something back to me and I will read it in real time. One of the things I've actually noticed is that people are very narcissistic. I know, yeah. It's ironic of me to say this because, like, I'm a fucking Twitch streamer. Like, I'm just a regular dude who thinks, like, everyone has to hear what I have to say. You know, we're podcasters. White guys doing podcasts, you know?
Wow. Fucking crazy.
Yeah, very unique. But one thing I have noticed is that a lot of people will utilize, or rather weaponize, like, the empathetic state that leftists have, because, like, their politics are one of compassion, usually, right?
Yeah.
To center the conversation around themselves. One immediate example of this that comes to mind from Twitter, at least, is like when the Kellogg's workers were on strike and they were demanding that you don't cross the picket line and you don't actually buy something from Kellogg's during that duration. And there was someone being like, no one is ready for that conversation, but I have like a food sensory issue and I have to eat Frosted Flakes, sweetie. And it's like, dude, you didn't have to fucking tweet that at all.
Yeah,
you just did that because you are a fucking narcissist. You want to be like, no, center the conversation about workers' rights around me, a person, who is not even involved in the production process in this regard, but is a worker elsewhere who probably would want solidarity if they were also in a similar predicament. But it's just like, yeah,
And what I'd say to that person is, like, if someone yells at you for not expressing solidarity to the workers, then explain your situation. Yeah. But there is a sort of an impulse to just go ahead.
That's what I mean. Yeah. Like, you could have literally just shut the fuck up and ate all the Frosted Flakes on the planet. Like, no one would know. But you chose to, like, make this a conversation point because you were like, oh, people are blindsided. Like, it's utilizing, or rather weaponizing, the intersectionality of leftist movements to just say, look at me, look at what I have to say. I have something to say and I need everybody to hear it. And I think that the DSA, for example, even though they do great work in many respects, will oftentimes fall prey to this, will fall victim to this, where I'm just like, my big principle always is like, I don't give a fuck. You're here to listen. If you come in here and start chirping about some random shit, like, I'm going to ban you. I think we need to, we need more of a Stalinist approach to DSA. To start purging the counter-revolutionaries and the anarchists. No, I'm just kidding.
Your point about all of this happening in the absence of larger structural change that would help marginalized communities, I think, is really the key of this, because there's, like, obviously, like, passing a bunch of policies, protecting rights for all people who have been marginalized and have been for years and years and years, like, that is the right way to go. That's not happening. And so then only being able to exert your power on social media. I mean, I feel like a lot of this is social media driven in a way that we didn't have this kind of thing about the left being very scoldy 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago.
Yeah. Well, it's like, no, it's definitely longer than that. I think, like, the earlier versions of this probably go back to, like, what? Rainbow Coalition, Jesse Jackson, and then, like, maybe was Howard Dean.
Yeah.
Like, the blogosphere that started propping up around the Howard Dean era. But, like, those OG podcasters and OG radio hosts were, like, you know, dudes like Sam Cedar, you know what I mean? Or even fucking Mark Maron at the time, you know, Air America guys, like, they didn't give a shit about any of that stuff. This is like, it's not new necessarily, but it's certainly become way more prominent on social media. I think, like, it's basically like the Tumblr contamination. When Tumblr eliminated pornography on their platform, everyone that was in Tumblr doing exactly these kinds of conversations where they were, like, hyper-medicalizing every condition and, like, constantly utilizing clinical psychology terms in their daily lives, like, super easily and oftentimes in the wrong ways, All of those people breached, the containment zone, and then they went to Twitter, they went to TikTok, and now they're everywhere. and they just, everyone talks like this. Republicans talk like this.
Yeah.
Well, which is funny.
But that's telling, right? Like, I think that social media has helped accelerate this trend. And you point out it's about narcissism in a way.
Yeah.
But that's what social media does. It puts you at the center of everything, right? It's your likes, your follows, your opinions. And I think that, that's sort of in line with a conservative philosophy, which is just, about extreme individualism. But on our side, the progressive movement succeeds when there is solidarity, when you realize, I have issues, someone else has issues, and I have to care about their issues and their rights as well as mine. And you have to have that, true intersectionality. And yeah. I don't know that social media really allows for that.
No, the unfortunate reality is that, I can't believe I'm using, a right-wing terminology almost for this, but, identity politics and the way that it's understood in America through the American exceptionalist, American individualist lens is, literally reactionary, so much so that I believe it was a part of the CIA handbook to very clearly infiltrate, any kind of anti-capitalist space and anti-capitalist organizing and disrupt it by utilizing specific talking points, bring up random irrelevant differences all the time and make them the focal point of conversation as a means to hold up any kind of organizing is literally written in the CIA handbook for leftist infiltration.
I mean, it's certainly what Russia tried to do with its propaganda. Other countries know that's our weakness too.
Yeah, it's very successful because it's a major security threat in many respects that Americans personally think, I'm an American citizen. I believe that I have very unique thoughts that no one has ever thought before. And by virtue of me having come up with this very unique thought, because I'm fucking awesome, everyone needs to hear me out, no matter how fucking stupid it is. And I'm always like, no, man, that's really fucking stupid. You don't know anything about vaccine science. Shut the fuck up. Just because you're you thought you cooked this up doesn't make you have to have a platform. You don't have to say these things.
Yeah, but everyone deserves a platform today.
Yeah, and it's
everyone
very
deserves
stupid.
Reach. The other big issue, I think, with social media as it relates to politics is I feel like it has led people, and cable news started this trend, but it's led a lot of people to believe that it's no longer worth trying to persuade people who don't share all of your political views.
Yeah, I disagree with that.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're a leftist who very much believes in doing the work of persuasion. And I always wonder when I come across someone like this, how'd you end up like that?
I'm just an annoying, stubborn guy, I think. I've also had changes in my own personal politics where, in some ways I've become, more radicalized throughout the years. But in many ways, way more tolerant. I talk about transphobia a lot, right? I'm a cishet white guy. I had transphobic opinions 10 years ago. Gender is a very rigid thing that we associate with ourselves. Though, even though it's socially learned, even though it's an expression, we reinforce that through every facet of society. You can't play with Barbies. You got to play with G.I. Joes if you're a boy, right? You got to wear blue. Even though if you look at FDR, when he was a baby, he just looks like a little girl. He's got a dress on, his hair is long. Those concepts have changed throughout time, but they become infinitely more rigid in contemporary society. And it's very personal to a lot of people, what their gender is. So when they see someone break that false notion that gender is actually biological and is very rigid and it is very important to me, what the fuck, it breaks their brain. So that's the reason why, and trans activists say this all the time, the overwhelming majority of Americans and the way that they receive trans people or the way that they think about trans people is just, they don't really think about trans people at all. They just have apathy. So you can go either direction after that. You meet a trans person, they're chill. You start learning and developing empathy for them, or you become this insanely transphobic person like Matt Walsh. And luckily, most Americans are not like Matt Walsh.
Right.
But why did I describe all of this? It's because I personally went through that journey of understanding and developing empathy for trans people and became an advocate for trans rights. And I think that everyone is capable of becoming more open-minded and reforming and, learning new things. And it's it certainly is one aspect of, I guess, the overall left, is that there is this false notion of justice that comes from thinking that, like, people are infallible, people are supposed to be perfect, they're not supposed to, like, have any sort of bad opinions. If you have any sort of bad opinions in the past, you have to hide it. If you have any sort of bad opinions now, we can't have disagreements, that means you're a bad person.
Yeah,
it's a bit of a cartoon because most people don't actually behave like that in the real world.
Never.
Right, you would never fucking sit across someone and be like, oh wow, you have a disagreement about, like, I don't know, fucking the criminal justice system, you're a fascist.
And also, I'm gonna call like 30 people over to the table and have them all start screaming at you.
Yeah, like that would never happen, right? So my point is that everyone, with the exception of like professional Republicans,
yeah,
you know, professional commentators, I would say everyone in the margins, everyone has a capability of changing their opinion on a particular matter. I don't think it happens through like contentious debate in the way that like a lot of people claim it does. I think that's just more for solidifying your positioning. And there is always a 20% in the middle that you could, you know, bring to your side. But like debates are not really about the truth. They're just about whose rhetoric is better overall. But I try to do that through just overall being a chill guy who talks about these issues,
yeah,
but well, is like an influencer otherwise.
I think that people who are intensely online, who pay super close attention to politics, they are exposed to a lot of people with their views. They're exposed to a lot of people with the polar opposite view. And they're not exposed to most people in this country who, first of all, don't really have a lot of political opinions, or at least don't have strong ones, don't really pay close attention to the news. And when they do have political opinions, a lot of times they're complicated and they have different positions on different issues. And I'm not saying that, like, we should just say, okay, well, because we got a compromise, we shouldn't go after those people. We should just let them. I think we should persuade them. But what I'm saying is, like, most people are gettable if you can sit down and persuade them, because, like you said, we've all gone through these sort of changes, and you have to think, oh, what persuaded me? Was it someone screaming at me, or was it someone trying to like reason with me and talk through it and point out evidence and talk about values? Like, there's a way that people can be persuaded still. Yeah. I just think it's hidden all the time.
For the record, I totally understand why people are angry all the time.
Oh yeah.
Especially online. Like, I get it. Especially if you're trans, if you're like, you know, if you're like a queer black teenager, you see so much violence against black people, you see so much violence against queer people, and you know that frustrates you. You feel like you constantly are on the defense. You got your guard up, and there's very valid reasons for you to, you know, for you to behave like that. So when you're always on the defensive, you pop off on people. So I'm not saying like all matter of like vitriolic or angry sentiment expressed by leftists online is completely stupid. I just mean that, like, you know, there are components of charitability that have been absolutely lost when a compassionate movement surrounding solidarity does start with foundational principles of taking on emotional labor every now and then, or at least relegating those responsibilities to someone who can if they are coming from a point of privilege. I'm, of course, talking about myself here, but these are things you can do and not constantly trying to center yourself in every conversation. Like, and you know, figuring out that there is a larger, in order for there to be a larger systemic change, like, you know, some of these conversations are going to be softened. Some of these talking points are going to be softened.
And I also think that work of showing generosity and grace and empathy, that is different than people calling for civility. I think sometimes people get those things mixed up.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, I'm
a very uncivil person. I'm a fucking caveman. I'm a barbarian. I say, you know, awful things. I do try to be as compassionate as possible to those who aren't there to basically exhaust my charitability and take up space and take up time away from other people who are genuinely there to learn. I sometimes happen to make mistakes as well when I just like pop off on someone from a misunderstanding. But overall, my main goal is just like, you know, make educational content that's entertaining. And I try to do that, and I want the most egalitarian, open way to do that as possible, which is You come into the chat, you follow for 10 minutes, you can say whatever you want. Very likely I'm going to read it.
Yeah. Every leftist's favorite president, Joe Biden, just announced he's running for re-election.
Yeah.
How are you feeling about a Biden-Trump rematch?
I mean, at this point, like, I've been so super checked out. Like, Bernie Sanders came out and was like, I'm not running, I'm endorsing him. And I was like, yeah, that's not surprising.
Yeah.
Like, you got the incumbent's advantage. If I put my, like, Democratic Party thinking hat on, you know what I mean? Like, anytime I talk about, like, electoral politics, like, I have to do that. It does make sense, like, because, I mean, Kamala Harris is awful.
You're not a fan, not a Kamala Harris
fan. No, she's so uncharismatic, like, and they also cooked her, like, not only is she so supremely uncharismatic, they also put her on, like, the worst assignments possible for a VP. Like, it almost felt like the Joe Biden team, I don't even think Biden was doing this personally, were just like, yeah, get fucked. You know, that's your, that, because, like, he's,
I mean, that
old.
Does happen to VPs a lot.
I know, but, like, if you're 800 years old, like, you should probably be like, oh, this is the next president, potentially. Yeah. Like, you should groom that person to be the next president, not, like, put them on toxic, hazardous waste duty.
Here's what I was worried about Kamala Harris, though, is that, like, this goes back to our earlier conversation, which is, like, to become the first woman vice president, first black South Asian, like, to get to achieve where she has, to get to the heights that she has in politics, she has probably had to walk such a tightrope over the years, right? Because of sexism, racism, a whole bunch of stuff. And I wonder if, as a politician, that makes you a little more cautious, a little more buttoned up, and it's, like, one of the reasons that she does seem so
I
don't know.
Do you know, there's a term that the youth call Riz. Do you know what this is?
No.
Riz. It's like shortened for charisma. If you go on TikTok, yeah, you'll probably see it.
Yeah.
Some people have Riz and some people don't have Riz. Ron DeSantis, no Riz. Okay.
No Riz. Yeah,
he's got no Riz. He's got no juice. He goes on television and says, it's sugar, man. And everyone's like, oh, that's gross. Stop. Please never fucking talk ever again. Or he's like, oh, maybe if I run. You know, like, you just see the fucking thing he said in Japan.
It looks like a bobblehead. Yeah.
Why are you in Japan?
That's
You're
what
the
I
governor
wanna
of
know.
Fucking Florida. What are you, like?
I don't understand what he was there for.
He's there to re-assassinate Shinzo Abe. He was like, I'm with the Moonies on this one. We gotta, or he's gonna go kill the guy who killed Shinzo Abe to defend the Moonies' honor. Anyway, very weird that he's in Japan in general. I guess he's trying to get his, like, foreign policy bona fides.
Yeah.
Not that, like, the Republican Party gives a fuck about that dumbass.
And also, like, a trip to Japan's not really going to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Or anyway, I really reevaluated the relationship between Tallahassee and, you know, the Kobe
Tokyo.
Prefecture. Like, thank you. So he doesn't have that charisma. Donald Trump does. Donald Trump is petty. He's a sassy bitch. But goddamn, does he make for good TV. Kamala Harris doesn't have that. You know, yeah, in spite of all these flaws, I think ultimately people do overlook that sort of thing. Barack Obama had it.
Yeah.
Barack Obama was, you know, Donald, I say this all the time. Donald Trump is the Barack Obama for white people. Like, where Barack Obama ran on, like, a very progressive platform, didn't follow through on a lot of those, you know, progressive platform promises. And, you know, I'm very critical of him. I mean, I know you worked for the guy.
I did.
But, like, he was profoundly charismatic. Like, he was on the campaign trail. Oh, my God, when he was fucking daggering Hillary Clinton on, like, the Iraq War stuff. Like,
yeah,
saying she's just, like, this, you know, corrupt institutionalist. Like, he was a once-in-a-lifetime charismatic figure that really popped off for that reason. And you can't build a strategy around, like, hoping that you're gonna have a freak like that.
Hey, so listen, whether you're in the States, across the pond, or somewhere on the other side of the world, we love that you tune into Crooked for US News. But did you know we also have a UK news show? Yes, that's right. It's called Pod Save the UK.
Pod Save the UK is a no-bullshit, unabashedly progressive conversation about politics focused on the issues that matter most to the people of Britain. With all the changes in our government, including the fun revolving door of prime ministers we have here, there's always lots to talk about.
And there's lots of fabulous guests to talk to. to journalists, politicians, experts, comedians, and activists.
Yeah, we've had great comedians on as well, like Rosie Jones, Stuart Lee, Aisling B. We've also had Tommy Vietor on, who may be our boss.
we still don't know.
We're not quite clear on who our boss is. I thought it might be Tommy Vietor. I thought it might be Jon Favreau. I don't know if it's John Lovett. It's hard to say. It's not clear to us who our bosses are.
Some of our listeners call us irreverent but not stupid.
I object to that.
Sound,
I'm deeply stupid.
Doesn't sound too bad. So look, come check us out. Come join us. Pod Save the UK every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
What do you think about Biden? I mean, that's someone who I would not say is the most charismatic.
No, that's
but
what
he's,
I mean.
But he's president of the United States right now.
I know, because at that point, like, Donald Trump literally got COVID before the election, which, like, re-emerged the fears that the American population had about how fucking terrible of a job he had done with COVID. The economy was tanking. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was like the worst possible storm for Donald Trump.
Look, I've always liked Joe Biden as a person. When I was in the White House, I worked with him. I thought he's just a kind, generous soul, right? He was not my choice in the primary by any means. Not only was he not my choice, I didn't think he would win. He did. And I actually think sometimes I do the experiment, okay, if it was Bernie Sanders in office over the last couple of years, if I really look through every single decision point, what would he have done differently or what would he have been able to achieve differently? And I don't know. Like, I actually think...
I can tell you.
What's that?
I think one of the most important... First of all, make no mistake. Bernie Sanders would be, would be getting called, perhaps justifiably even, a fascist American imperialist by the very same leftists that ended up voting for him, including maybe even myself at certain points. Any, like, there is 0% chance that Bernie Sanders would, like, legitimately, I don't know... take away resources from like Israel until they stop the apartheid. You know what I mean? Like that was never going to happen. Like, you know, it's
so
just
I think that's a good point that that probably foreign policy where the president has the most power to do what they want is probably where Bernie might've been the most different.
Look, Eisenhower was right. He was wrong on a lot of things, but he was right on this one where he said, you know, the military industrial complex is going to destroy this country. Is the most powerful force, the most powerful institution. Absolutely correct. It is. It is the most viable industry that we have. It is profoundly important. We're going to do their bidding no matter what happens because it's like creating new opportunities for foreign capital to come in and seize. We're extracting natural resources as a consequence of that. We're constantly keeping prices down as a consequence of that. That volatility, that instability is good for like Western, like other Western capitalists that, can cut into the market and like sell their own liquid petroleum or whatever the fuck, right? So there's all of that. Bernie Sanders was not going to change that. But what could he have done? One thing that he said that I truly believe in is something that Obama kind of said and then didn't do when he became president, which was outside forces, that our work would only begin once Bernie Sanders was in office and he would do everything in his power to ensure that like labor unions could truly form and have more power in the country and become more dominant once again in the political arena. And that it wasn't going to be the singular individual from the top turning around and being like, we're going to purge the non-believers in the Democratic Party. And, you know, I'm going to start kicking out Republicans from Senate or anything like that. The president doesn't have that kind of power anyway, unless they're a Republican, then they can do whatever the fuck they want.
Right.
But none of those things were going to happen. Like, but
well, it feels like the next step would be passing the PRO Act. And like, he couldn't get that through Congress.
I think even if he couldn't get that through Congress, I think he would have weaponized the bully pulpit. Like, think about how Donald Trump utilized the bully pulpit to really beef up white supremacy, so much so that you thought, like, these decentralized...
But he didn't need legislation for that.
No, I know. But my point is this. He was able to get these otherwise incredibly fringe groups that were, like, super decentralized to come together and, like, demonstrate in a country that, like, killed Nazis not that fucking long ago. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, they got so confident that they could do that. So my point is, the president does have a very powerful weapon. It's called the bully pulpit, as you know. And I think Bernie Sanders would have been able to effectively utilize that to push for more organizing outside of the political sphere so that you could have more, you know, people participation in politics in general. And, maybe I'm a little too naive or too hopeful, but I think that that paired up with like some legislation and actually bullying, you know, the constant rotating villain inside of the Democratic Party would have been able to like, at the very least, make incremental change in the positive direction, in the right direction. I was never thinking that, like, you know, Bernie's going to bring about the Green New Deal like that. You know, he's not going to be able to do any of that. When FDR was able to do the New Deal, there was a lot of concessions that he made still that we look not so fondly on. And it's understandable, like carving out black people from a lot of these, you know, a lot of these amenities. But there was outside pressures that forced FDR's hand. You had both the, you know, the business plot fascist capitalists that were like, let's kill this guy. This guy fucking sucks. And then you also had like a viable coalitions of trade unionists, communists, social democrats, socialists in this country. Like Eugene Debs got, you know, 2 million votes or something like that from fucking prison.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, I think with Biden, it's interesting because like I would argue that we wouldn't have the, I mean, he prioritized, you know, Joe Manchin wrote the Inflation Reduction Act, obviously, but he basically gave Biden a choice, like, which policies do you want to prioritize here? I don't think he would have prioritized climate had it not been for the outside pressure from young people and climate activists to really care about climate. I don't think he would have tried to cancel student loan had it not been for a lot of outside pressure.
That's wild, though. Think about that. That's like such a gimme. The student loan thing is such a easy. That's so easy. That's easy politics.
Look, I think it's. I'm very much for it. I think that the politics of it is still like, you look at the polling. It's not as popular as I would think.
No, I don't believe that.
Because people think like.
Yeah, because the media is constantly fucking up the assholes of like, even Nancy Pelosi is like, they have big donors that are in student loan refinancing that literally juice up all of these fucking programs. You got like people who did literal corporate PR for debt refinancing companies that go on CNN and MSNBC and be like, is it really fair that people are, you know, getting some of their student loan debt relief here? No one's asking the question, why the fuck are people paying?
You also get like working class people who will say that too, and they'll be like, I fucking paid for college. Why some rich kid in a city somewhere?
Yeah, because they're stupid. Like, I'm sorry.
There's a lot of people.
You're a mean person and you're a stupid person.
Yeah, there's a lot of that out there.
It's the counter to that is so simple. It's like, oh, wow. Like, if there was a fucking cancer vaccine tomorrow, you'd be like, oh, well, sorry. I went through chemotherapy. You shouldn't get
cancer
vaccine.
I paid for my chemo.
Yeah, like, what are you, fucking insane?
It's crazy. So I do think that, like, it is a huge frustration of mine, always has been, that Democrats do not break through on economic messaging, even when they try, and oftentimes they don't try. And I think, like, even if you just go strictly from polling, like, economic populism is very popular, right? And yet, it also doesn't break through because the media doesn't. Economic issues, unless it's a crisis.
They don't need to be, but I think the media is, again, too invested in the other side, so that's part of the reason why, like, whenever they talk about economic policy, they take an insanely anti-populist stance, and they oftentimes have, like, these, you know, big brand econ guys come in and talk about these issues, and then you find out that, like, you know, if they were wearing, like, a NASCAR jacket of their fucking corporate sponsors, like, you'd be like, oh, I get why this guy's saying, you know, that we can't have healthcare in this country. You work for Cigna. Like, the fuck up.
But it's also, you know, like, Barack Obama said fat cats once about the fucking CEOs at the banks after the financial crisis. And we dealt with it for, like, a month. Maybe being like, is he some crazy populist now because he called them fat cats?
Yeah,
like,
that's not a bad thing. And that kind of populism literally also played a role in Donald Trump coming across, like, unique and genuine, despite the fact that he was a fucking spoiled fail son whose daddy carried him to financial prosperity, even though he kept fucking it up over and over again.
Yeah.
So, like, it's mind-boggling that this dude born in New York with a silver spoon in his mouth was able to come across like he was this populist leader. And he did that because he was saying things that other people were not saying.
Yeah.
And I think that gets lost a lot, or maybe even some people are fearful of that kind of narrative because it goes against their corporate benefactors' best interests. Going back to Joe Biden, though, as far as like what Joe Biden has done, I think that There are a lot of issues with the Biden administration from my perspective, which most Americans, I don't even think, care about. You know, not allowing the railroad workers to truly fight for better contracts where, you know, you're forcing the hand of these like four major railroad corporations that have basically carved out the United States of America as their own fucking territories. And they literally own the railroads as well as the train carts on top of them. The unions were absolutely correct on demanding that more people should be hired for the railroads and that they should get time off. It was a totally valid thing to ask. And Joe Biden absolutely did not give them that at all and utilized in the one instance where he had some power and influence, he used it in the opposite direction.
Yeah, they were worried about a strike and the economic fallout and what that would do to the larger. Yeah,
I totally get that. But here's two.
But you're right. In the moment, he could have.
Here's two ways to communicate that. Always, capitalist dogma dictates that whenever there's a union strike, whenever there's like even talk of a strike, work stoppage happening, that it's always at the fault of the union. It's always the workers that are actually causing the strike to happen. Why are they being selfish?
Yeah.
Why are they doing a strike? It's like there's two sides to every kind of contract negotiation. Why does the media never talk about the manager side, the boss side, the employer side, and their responsibility to offer a fair contract to these striking workers that want simply just a small fraction of the percentage.
A couple days off.
A small fraction of the percentage of the value that they are generating for this company. It's not like they're saying like, you know, we're overthrowing you. This is a workers' council. We have a fucking vanguard that is going to control the railroad companies and the nation eventually. They're not like, you know, rugged Marxist-Leninists. They're just guys that are like, we want some time off.
Yeah.
I want to see my children. I want to not go to work sick.
What's your best pitch to a 20-something in a swing state who's not sure if they want or bother to vote in 2024?
Well, I mean, I say this all the time on my stream, but I don't really care that much about the top of the ticket. Obviously, it's, you know, it's the most significant, least significant thing you can do. You know what I mean? But you should absolutely vote for your ballot measures. You should absolutely learn everything you can about your ballot measures and vote for your local politicians, because those guys will have immediate and tangible impacts on your life.
But you would say that, but like, you know, whether we get Biden or Trump, seems like, for all your criticisms of Biden, it's still a big deal.
There's a difference between Biden and Trump. I mean, I still voted for Biden, but ultimately, I totally understand why you feel powerless. I'm just saying, like, you got to get your foot in the door regardless for the down ballot shit.
Yeah.
So while you're there, vote for the guy that's marginally better. Ultimately, do I think that is going to like dramatically change the outcome? I think that we greatly exaggerate how different things are between both parties when like both parties kind of move the needle like this, and the real damaging stuff happens over a lifetime. The Republican Party did not eviscerate abortion rights and a woman's right to choose and, like, you know, these fundamental liberties, the civil liberties that people took for granted for so long in one election cycle. I know that Donald Trump...
They won a bunch of Senate seats in really conservative states.
Yeah, but the reality is that was a 40-year project by the Federalist Society that was successful ultimately. There was billions of dollars of capital being pushed into it. You go to fucking North Carolina, you got the Federalist Society right there, UNC, UNC Law School, Federalist Society is right there, literally, you know, plucking every fucking frat bro who's like, I want to be a lawyer one day. You know what I mean? Like,
well, to your local point, they have put so much money over decades into focusing on local races. That's why we have fucking state legislatures that are basically like one party states now.
Oh, yeah.
Some of these
Wisconsin.
Red states.
Wisconsin is fucking insane.
But Wisconsin was a good example too, where I was like, I had given up. I was like, oh God, the gerrymandering there, we're fucked. And then the Supreme Court race, then we won the Supreme Court race. And I'm like, now, like, that's a good argument to me about like why you never give up on states like that.
Yes, exactly. Of course not. Yeah. I'm not an advocate for giving up on any state whatsoever.
No.
But that's why I'm saying, like,
focus on
the real boring minutia is actually where it fucking matters.
Yeah.
Like, your council district member is going to have more power over your immediate life. Like, you're is going to have more tangible differences in your way of existence than the fucking president, because like the American government runs like a machine on autopilot. I think Trump proved that pretty
And by the way, well, if you get involved in local politics and you see that local politics can actually change your life and your community for the better, you're more likely to be involved in politics, right? Yeah. You're less likely to stop having so much distrust in the system if you can see it in front of you working.
Yeah, you want to know how you also feel that way, though? You want to know how we participate more? Workplace organizing.
Yeah.
Labor unions were the reason why people felt like they had a say in this process, even if there wasn't an immediate say. And I'm not even talking about labor unions now, but there was a point in time when, like, you know, you did feel like you had some level of influence over the Democratic Party. At least I feel like with union participation at 10%, 11%, which is literally lower than Chile, by the way. This is a fun fact for everybody listening at home. We wrote their fucking constitution. Like, we wrote a neoliberal constitution in Chile, okay? We did a coup. We did all of that. We were awful to Chile. And even then, they still have a higher labor union participation in that country than we do here in America.
Yeah.
Because...
And by the way, you can trace sort of, the labor unions in this country also used to be, like, the central infrastructure for the Democratic Party.
Yes.
Right? And that's that's why you had a lot of people. And when as unions declined, that's when the party lost a lot of working class people.
It's absolutely.
No coincidence, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Manufacturing went overseas. You know, capital owners wanted to squeeze out profit. Profit rates have a tendency to decline. I didn't come up with that. Some other bearded dude did 200 fucking years ago. He was right. And then another guy said imperialism is a necessity for to ensure that, you know, profits stay stable, even though it's constantly declining. Another guy who was bald and had a mustache said that. Both of those guys are very smart, I think. But regardless, this system is designed in a way to continue that, to continue finding profit wherever. And if you are doing that kind of devastation overseas, it's inevitably going to come back.
Yeah.
If our military is being brutal and awful in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, if we have 700 military bases all around the country and we're doing, like, direct violence, direct acts of violence in places that are overseas, we're sending, you know, 12,000 young men and women to die in the war on terror, right? Hundreds of thousands more to come back in a state of constant PTSD. You know, 22 veterans are killing themselves every day. Like, all of this stuff is happening so that the bottom line of corporations is protected, that shareholder value is protected, that global capital ends up, you know, behaving in the way that it's supposed to. This is a very powerful structure that we've designed. And it's so great in maintaining its stability. Neoliberalism is great at maintaining stability. That even when you speak out against it, like, people who don't benefit from it at all will come out and, like, speak out against it and yell at you and say that you're in the wrong.
Do you see yourself as a political activist? Like, how much do you feel like your role is to get your audience involved in politics at all? Or, like, how do you think about that?
I think a lot of people in my audience do get involved in politics. They become labor organizers. They become community organizers. They run for, you know, local office and whatnot, and that's great. But I see myself as just some guy. That's the way I see it. I am what would happen if you were like an influencer who just, I guess, read Capital and just kind of went along with it.
What drew you to Twitch as a platform?
I play video games, or I used to. I don't really play video games online as much. I still do, but offline. I saw the space. I knew that the space was very diverse, but unfortunately the output from, like, video game essayists and commentators were, like, incredibly right-wing.
Yeah.
And I think that they were radicalizing a lot of people. And YouTube probably played a big role in that too, like the YouTube algorithm. But I saw that and I was like, this is not right. This is not correct. I think there are a lot of people that also would understand my perspective and would probably mesh better with my worldview than these, like, neck-bearded divorced dads that are talking about, you know, the great replacement and you know, having Richard Spencer on.
Yeah.
Those guys are fucking weirdo losers, you know what I mean? And they're not real gamers either.
The other thing with Twitch is that it's all, like, it's live. You're interacting with your audience in real time. Like, I spend most of my week prepping for all these podcasts. I, like, get to spend a lot of time thinking about what I want to say, how I want to respond to the news. You're just, like, responding in real time. What is that like?
I mean, that was also part of the reason why I got on Twitch, because originally when I was at the Young Turks, I would write for Huffington Post and I would write all of my scripts out, and they were all, pre-scripted, all the assets that I would collect and whatnot. And then I would make these like short 5-minute videos about one particular subject in the news on that day. I wanted to get better at off the cuff commentary. Like I had all these ideas. I had all these opinions, but I could never communicate it adequately when I didn't have this crutch, you know, a teleprompter. Yeah. So,
or like when you're self-editing all the time too. Yeah. That's the other.
Yeah. So basically I wanted to get better at free flow conversation. And what better way to do that than, you know, just putting yourself in the crossfire, putting yourself in front of the crosshairs of thousands of people for uninterrupted 10 hours where you can't have any sort of dead air. That's why I don't shut the fuck up. If you noticed, you have me on the podcast. I rolled out of bed. I didn't do any prep work for this, but I haven't shut the fuck up at all.
But I'm sure that you also it's strengthening the relationship with your audience because you're always responding to them, right? Like
for sure.
We do live shows and then we get to see people, and it's one of the best parts of doing this because I actually get to talk to people, but you don't get that feedback all like in real time all the time. It must be nice to actually have that sort of.
Yes and no. I think it's really great and it helps me recenter my focus, but it also can be bad because people can like weaponize that.
Yeah.
Like they can use that against you and like come in and say like insane shit. Just curious is the phrase that we make fun of all the time. People would be like, why did you buy a $7 trillion mansion in West Hollywood? Just curious. It's like... No, you're not just curious. Like, that wasn't a question.
Also, there's like 10 jokes that everyone uses over and over again that are really not that funny anymore.
Yeah.
Someone once described you in an article by saying, Hassan consumes the internet at the speed of the internet. This show's called Offline. We talk about being extremely online and how to unplug. Does it ever get exhausting, like, being online, consuming content constantly? Like, do you ever try to unplug?
Sometimes burnout is very real, and I do go live for 8 hours on the minimum every day, 7 days a week.
That's so long.
And I talk about politics for a big chunk of that. Some ways to mitigate that is by shifting my content on the tail end, on like after hour 4, 5, 6. Try to do some more lighthearted fun commentary.
Yeah.
Play video games every now and then, things of that nature. And, you know, there's still politics kind of involved in it because it's just who I am. I can't turn it off. But overall, you know, that's one way to mitigate burnout, like to combat it. And then sometimes I just take a day off, you know?
That's good.
And
on the day off, are you not looking at the news all day long?
Usually I am more aggressively, but lately I've gotten a lot better. And now with the puppy, it's like impossible for me to look at the news nonstop. So that has actually been kind of helpful.
Yeah. Puppy's a good distraction. It's a good way to unplug.
Yeah. And I have like a social life. I have this like rigid work structure that I definitely follow aggressively, but that work structure also has like blocks that I have for working out, for example, and like socializing. So I, you know, get some sunlight. I work outdoors with my trainers and I play basketball, go to public parks. You know, those are things that I think keep me a little bit more grounded.
Mm.
And, you know, I do stuff like that, even though I do have the perfectly broken brain for 8 hours of uninterrupted commentary while I'm like, processing information at the speed of the internet.
Hassan Piker, thanks for joining Offline, and good luck with the puppy.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me, guys.
Of course. Offline is a Crooked Media production. It's written and hosted by me, Jon Favreau. It's produced by Austin Fisher. Emma Illick-Frank is our associate producer. Andrew Chadwick is our sound editor. Kyle Seglin, Charlotte Landis, and Vasilis Fotopoulos sound engineered the show. Jordan Katz and Kenny Siegel take care of our music. Thanks to Michael Martinez, Ari Schwartz, Amelia Montooth, and Sandy Gerard for production support. And to our digital team, Elijah Cohn and Rachel Gajewski, who film and share our episodes as videos every week.
Hey! Okay, so listen, whether you're in the States, across the pond, or somewhere on the other side of the world, we love that you tune into Crooked for US News. But did you know we also have a UK news show? Yes, that's right. It's called Pod Save the UK.
Pod Save the UK is a no-bullshit, unabashedly progressive conversation about politics focused on the issues that matter most to the people of Britain. With all the changes in our government, including the fun revolving door of prime ministers we have here, there's always lots to talk about.
And there's lots of fabulous guests to talk to. Journalists, politicians, experts, comedians and activists.
Yeah, we've had great comedians on as well, like Rosie Jones, Stuart Lee, Aisling B. We've also had Tommy Vietor on, who may be our boss.
We still don't know.
We're not quite clear on who our boss is. I thought it might be Tommy Vietor. I thought it might be Jon Favreau. I don't know if it's John Lovett. It's hard to say. It's not clear to us who our bosses are.
Some of our listeners call us irreverent but not stupid.
I object to that. I'm deeply
stupid.
It doesn't
sound too bad. So look, come check us out. Come join us. Pod Save the UK every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.